Dedicated to the survival of American democracy in an increasingly dangerous world, this is Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney, acted as Assistant Secretary of Defense for International Security Policy under President Ronald Reagan, founder of the Center for Security Policy in Washington, D.C., the go-to man for defense and foreign policy issues, joined by the greatest minds in the security policy business, the special forces in the war of ideas at Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney.
Welcome to Secure Freedom Radio. This is Frank Gaffney, your host and guide for what I think of as an intelligence briefing on the war for the free world. In Washington, there are a few men who have spent more time helping the rest of us understand the various aspects of the war for the free world than our first guest. He is Peter Husey. He has extensive experience on Capitol Hill in the executive branch and in the private sector in the business of analyzing threats to our country, and has put some focused attention, I'm very pleased to say, of late on the nation and regime of the Islamic Republic of Iran. He has, among other things, to his credit, the role of Director for Strategic Deterrence Studies at the Mitchell Institute for Aerospace Studies, and has been a contributor to The Hill newspaper and the Gatestone Institute. I wanted to catch up with him about some of his thoughts on what do we do about Iran. Peter Husey, welcome back. It's so good to have you with us. Let's talk a little bit about the character of the Iranian regime. I think we can stipulate that it's odious and dangerous. What, in your judgment, makes it something we have to bring about the end of?
Well, you have to start with a number of things. First is the constitution in Iran that says that their job is to export the revolution. Someone called it soldiers without borders. I call it jihadis without borders. There is no place that they don't think they have the right to go to expand what you know is Sharia law, which is Islamic law, which is basically would get rid of our freedoms and our Bill of Rights and turn us into basically slaves. And we've seen that in Lebanon. We've seen that in Yemen. We've seen that in parts of Iraq and, of course, in Iran itself, as well as Syria. And the Iranians are not bashful about supporting every different kind of jihadi terror group in the world, both Sunni and Shia, doesn't matter, and with the goal of first kicking America and any Western influence out of the Gulf and then expanding their empire after that. And the key is we may be almost, depending on the month, free of imported oil on a net basis. But if they gain control of the Persian Gulf and 70% of the conventional oil and gas hydrocarbons in the world, you're talking about multiple tens of trillions of dollars, plus the control over the industrialized world, particularly in Europe, Japan, and the Pacific, where they would have enormous leverage, which you don't want to give a country like that, let alone the kind of money that they could use then to expand both their war aims and their terrorism and their search, of course, for nuclear weapons. And given that this is not a regime with which you talk about reform, it is you have to get rid of the regime. And part of that is what the maximum pressure economically by this administration, which has resulted in a lot of people in Iran wanting to get rid of the regime.
Well, I gather they've wanted to for quite some time. In many cases, it's just not been achieved. Which brings me to the real question, Peter. You've written about this at Gatestone. What does the United States need to do at this point to try to help them accomplish the end of the horrible regime that oppresses them and threatens us?
Right. I go back to the President Reagan's idea, which was you help people help themselves. And you get serious about it. We did it with respect to El Salvador. We did it with respect to Nicaragua. We did it with respect to Angola. And we also did it with respect to Afghanistan and other places where we help people fight for their freedom. And tragically, in Afghanistan, while the Northern Alliance was on our side and a group of people we could deal with, the Pakistanis created the Taliban during the Civil War after the Russians left. And the Taliban basically took over from other elements in Iran and in Afghanistan. And you know where that went to. So what do we need to do with respect to Iran? First of all, we are giving them radios and communications gear that gets around the Iranian attempt to shut them down so they can talk to each other. With Solidarity in Poland, what we did is we gave them strike funds, meaning if they're in prison or when they had martial law, the people still had money to survive as families. We also had a wild card, which is called the Pope, which could get all this to the Polish people through the churches, which we don't have in Iran. But if you look around the periphery of Iran, you have the Hajjabanis, you have the Iraqis, you have the Afghanis. You have people who hate them. Do not like this regime, because this regime is not only in the business of selling drugs and exporting guns and killing people and is a terrorist regime, they want it gone. The question in my mind is we should give weapons of whatever kind is needed to the periphery so they can give them to their friends inside Iran, which can then take down the regime, because I don't see how you get rid of the Revolutionary Guard Corps or whether you get rid of the mullahs themselves without basically having guns. It's basically a Second Amendment lesson, if you will.
Indeed, it is. So you're not arguing that we ought to put our own forces into Iran for this purpose?
Well, let's say you bomb Iran and you bomb some part and you take out the Navy base, you take out a refinery, or you take out oil depots and so forth. Okay, then what? Okay, you've harmed them economically, which we need to still deter them. We still need missile defenses. We still need offensive strike weapons to go after when they come do anything that we can deter, like killing Soleimani. Do it. But I don't want to land the 82nd Airborne in downtown Tehran. I don't know what the heck to do. But the people of Iran, they are the people that are going to have to get rid of this regime, but they can't do it without both the equipment, technical equipment to talk to each other and plan and plot, as well as the weapons needed to take these people down, because the Revolutionary Guard Corps and the mullahs are a vicious group of people, and they've killed well over 1,000 of their own people during the recent demonstrations. So their willingness to kill their own people is very, you know, that quotient's very high. But we're talking deadly serious stuff here, because you think North Korea's bad with nuclear weapons. Iran is allied with them, and the Iranians are getting better and better with ballistic missiles. They're getting new guidance sets put on them, and the Russians have helped them with GPS guidance.
For example, we've learned recently that there are some 100 American servicemen who were physically harmed, traumatic brain injury, as a result of those missile attacks that were launched against their positions in Iraq. Peter, let me just ask you the pregnant question that is often asked to me when I espouse regime change in Iran. I think it's absolutely necessary, as you do. Is what comes next? Who do we anticipate would fill the vacuum? What are your thoughts on that question, and how important is it to us to know the answer before we actually try to achieve this outcome?
Well, what I'm trying to do is put together a conference here in Washington with both the people from expatriates from Iran and specialists on Iran, and put together a group which would look at exactly that question. What comes next? If you get rid of the regime, what happens? And similar to what people talked about at the height of the war in Nazi Germany, part of my relatives and adopted relatives, so to speak, the German resistance, part of what they looked at is what the heck comes after the Nazis. We have to prepare for that. In respect to Iran, we have to look at what kind of regime could Iran put together that would not be certainly this regime, hopefully not worse, but something better. And the question is, they would need help from us and the region. And that, I think, is what I'm trying to do in the next couple of months, is put together such an event.
We'll look forward to hearing more about it. I do think the endless challenge, of course, is also how do we integrate and empower those within Iran who seek this outcome as well, so it's not just the expats and people who don't seem to have skin in the game.
No, they don't. The people inside Iran today who are there, they're the ones that are going to change the regime. The question is, can they get the tools? In my view, Frank, is the international community, whatever you want to call it, but everybody in Europe, everybody in the United States and Canada and Japan, they should be helping these people overthrow this regime, period.
And they're not doing it, which is a subject for another day's conversation with you, Peter Husey. I'm afraid we're at the end of our time for today, but thank you. We appreciate your leadership on this subject, both that you're expressing through your publications, including a terrific piece at Gatestone last month, as well as this very exciting new conference. We'll look forward to hearing more about it days ahead. Thank you, my friend. We'll talk with you again soon. Next up, we'll speak with Dr. Mark Schneider about developments in the nuclear space that are quite alarming and need an effective response as well, right after this.
Visit us at facebook.com/securefreedom with Frank Gaffney. You're listening to Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney from the nation's capital in Washington, D.C.
Welcome back. We're joined by Dr. Mark Schneider, one of the country's preeminent authorities on matters involving nuclear forces, deterrence, and arms control. I had the privilege of working with Mark Schneider decades ago in the Pentagon. He went on to continue to serve there, drawing on his experiences as a senior executive, as well as a foreign service officer, to become really one of the duty experts on the whole issue of the challenges we face from nuclear armed adversaries and what we must do about it. He's these days a fellow with the National Institute for Public Policy and a prolific contributor to the public policy debate. It's always a delight to have him with us. Dr. Schneider, welcome back, my friend. This is a moment when it seems, Mark, there's a lot going on in your portfolio, and yet it doesn't seem to be getting nearly the attention that it deserves. Let's start by talking a little bit, and briefly, unfortunately, but a little bit about what we are watching happen with respect to Russian, well, and if we can, Chinese nuclear force deployments, and whether this constitutes a significant ramping up of the threat we're facing from those quarters.
Well, there's no question we are seeing a very serious expansion in both China, Chinese and Russian nuclear forces, and that in both cases, their capabilities are probably significantly larger than they're generally given credit for. And they're going to increase over the next year, next 10 years, excuse me.
And this is a function of a long-term investment program that both countries have been engaging in, Mark. But in addition to the new weapons that they're building and deploying and the strategic force exercises that they've engaged in to some extent jointly, which feature strategic nuclear attacks against the United States, many of them presided over by Vladimir Putin personally. We're also seeing some deployments that are rather alarming, and you've been writing about that at Real Clear Defense and Proceedings magazine. Could you just give us a quick update on that?
Well, the Russians in December, and this is typical, they do this every year, released a lot of information on their plans for strategic nuclear forces. And there are some major developments, things that even I didn't expect in one case. They announced in December two additional Bure-class ballistic missile submarines. And more significant than that, they announced a program to deploy 20 regiments of the Sarmat heavy ICBM. That's the most destructive weapon that will exist. It's not yet operational. It will be in a few years. But it is the most destructive weapon. When it becomes operational, it will be the most destructive weapon that's ever been created. Now, 20 regiments, Russian regiments for ICBMs contain either 6 or 10 launchers. So you're dealing with something between 120 and 200 launchers for a heavy ICBM, which the Russian Defense Ministry has stated can carry 20 warheads each. So that's a lot of firepower. And this has gotten literally almost zero coverage. I mean, I wrote it up in a Real Clear Defense article on Russian breakout. But when I wrote that thing, outside of three reports in the Russian press, including two in state media, all I could find in Western sources was one tweet, literally one tweet.
Now, Mark, let me just ask you, again, you have incredible corporate memory as well as current knowledge. I've written that it seems to me if this were going on in the Cold War, if we saw the kind of buildup that's taking place, the modernization program, the comprehensive cross-the-board modernization program, the exercises, the seeming determination to employ a doctrine of first use of nuclear weapons, that we would be at a heightened state of alert given the cumulative impact of that threat. As you say, we're not even seemingly taking note of it, let alone responding to it. And I just have to ask, we've seen the president's new budget. There have been discussions of the increased funding for our nuclear deterrent as kind of a buildup of our own. How would you characterize what the president is proposing, which of course is a long way from being actualized, but how would you characterize it as well as relative to what the Russians, to say nothing of the Russians and Chinese, are about?
Well, he has proposed a significant increase, long overdue, by the way, in funding for our nuclear deterrent forces. Now, if you compare it to what the Russians have been doing for the last 20 years, it's fairly small while they are modernizing constantly, every time they introduce a new system, they've started work on the next system, either an improved version or a new system to replace it with. In the U.S. case, we're doing the minimum modernization to sustain the triad. We have a long-term program. We'll start introducing the first new systems in the late 2020s and some of them in the early 2030s. And the Russians have just announced that they will complete the modernization of their strategic nuclear forces by 2024. Now, that's probably a little optimistic on the date, but the reality is there's no question, one, that they will modernize their entire strategic nuclear force many years before we will even start our modernization, and two, that the modernization is going to be continuous. And actually, Putin just said this during the December statements they made, speeches and presentations for the press that they made. What he said was, we're not going to just modernize our forces and then sit on our laurels for the next 20 or 30 years, by the way, which is what we're planning to do. We're going to continuously modernize everything. And he's absolutely correct.
And when you say modernized, Mark Schneider, you're talking not only about various platforms and missile delivery systems and aircraft. You're talking about the weapons themselves as well, are you not? And is there any comparable effort being made by the United States to design and build new nuclear warheads to accompany somewhat improved platforms and missiles on our side?
No, absolutely not on the nuclear warhead part of this. We're doing life extension without any improvements with one exception where we put a guidance package on the B-61 bomb. There's no improvement in anything else in terms of its military capabilities and no new types of nuclear weapons. The thing about the Russian modernization program, modernization is an understatement because we're not just talking about making an existing system a little better or even a lot better. Almost all the modernization programs involve the development, testing, and deployment of completely new weapon systems. And the same thing is going on in the nuclear warhead business. And there's a lot of evidence of that in the Russian press. Matter of fact, I went through some of this evidence in the publication that you actually published for me on yes, the Russians are testing nuclear weapons, and it's really serious. And there's a lot of evidence that they are doing dramatic. They're going for dramatic improvements in military capabilities of their nuclear weapons. Well, we're not doing that at all.
And we may not even really understand the cumulative effects of all of these investments, right? Because they're doing this very secretively. The degree of actual visibility into these programs is de minimis. And that's one of the things that I also wanted to talk with you very quickly about, Mark Schneider, and that is some of the insights in the past have been ascribed to our various arms control deals with the Russians, before them the Soviet Union. The present agreement, the New START agreement, we're being told by a particularly problematic now NATO official, Rose Gottmuller, a longtime Obama and Clinton apparatchik in the arms control space, is that we need to extend this New START treaty. You've written about this at, again, Real Clear Defense, and I want you to just quickly talk about the reported interest of the Trump administration in getting back into arms control negotiations with the Russians and the Chinese on these strategic forces. What's up with that?
Well, certainly the argument that Rose Gottmuller made about preventing breakout is completely disingenuous. She's pointing at one of the most serious defects of the New START treaty and claiming it's one of its important strengths, and it's just the opposite. I pointed out in that article that breakout from an arms control treaty, which means discarding it and producing substantially higher levels of nuclear forces and cheating on the treaty, which is essentially a covert breakout while the treaty is in force. These are essentially two sides of the same coin. You need exactly the same type of capabilities.
And the Russians actually have built in those capabilities, have they not?
Yes. And the biggest problem with the New START Treaty is that they've eliminated all the prohibitions that were built in the original START Treaty that were designed and had substantial capability to prevent this very sort of thing.
Mark, we have to wrap on this note. There is much more to talk about, in particular with respect to what do we do about all of this on the U.S. side, whether it's our own nuclear deterrent forces, their modernization, arms control, and more, to say nothing of what do we do about the Chinese. We'd love to have you back for a longer conversation very soon, Mark, if we can. We're out of time today, but thank you for all you do to try to keep us apprised about the challenges that we're facing. Whether we choose to ignore them or not, they are real, they are growing, and they are potentially nation-ending. So God bless you, my friend. Thank you for your service to our country in all of these respects. Come back to us again, if you would, very soon. Next up, we'll speak with Kevin Freeman right after this.
Now more with Frank Gaffney.
Welcome back. It's time for our weekly visit with the man who is the master of the economic war room, with Kevin Freeman on Blaze TV. He is, of course, Kevin Freeman, the author of Game Plan and Secret Weapon, two best-selling books, and a superb blog, globaleconomicwarfare.com. We are always delighted to have him with us, but especially when there is so much going on in the economic warfare arena. Kevin, welcome back. It's good to have you, sir. Let's talk a little bit about this speech. I'm going to discuss it briefly with Fred Flights as well in a moment, but I'd like to get your thoughts. Mike Pompeo addressed the state's governors over the weekend and did really some very tough love about what they are actually being subjected to in terms of targeting by the Chinese, influence operations and penetration, subversion, espionage, and not least having their pension funds underwrite some very dubious Chinese companies. Your thoughts?
Well, first off, it's wonderful to see the Secretary of State actually acknowledging that China is not always our friend. China is an adversary and potentially an enemy. He covered a lot of ground, which was helpful, because the Chinese are trying to divide us. They're trying to find groups, whether they're individual states or whether they're individual businesses, that will toe their line against the national interest. And Secretary Pompeo brought out the truth. And so we've got to not underwrite our enemies. They've been accessing our capital markets and have literally trillions of dollars worth of American money propping up their economy. So I applaud him, and I applaud the Committee on the Present Danger of China for bringing it to his attention.
It raises a related point, Kevin, which you have been working on for some time now, specifically with your National Security Investment Consultants Institute. Namely, there are alternatives for American capital that could strengthen our country and enable our innovation and otherwise protect our national security as well as our commercial competitiveness. Why is it that Wall Street is favoring our enemies in China over such American investments, as you see it?
Well, unfortunately, the Wall Street is globalist by nature. They consider themselves to be citizens of the world rather than citizens of the United States. And they've adopted this ESG investing, environmental, social, and governance, that really is has a globalist perspective to it. And, you know, we're pushing through the NSIC LSV, which is liberty, security, and values, economic and personal liberty, national security, cybersecurity, personal security, and Western civilization values. We think that's where people should be investing.
As opposed to environment, social, governance, ESG. I gather. Now, that has been rich, as far as I'm concerned, when you have these globalists in Wall Street promoting this, well, globalist agenda. It's, you know, it's the green environment, it's social justice, it's good governance, meaning the use of shareholder assets and equities to basically promote these various causes. And yet, they are simultaneously, these globalists, doing what you talked about a moment ago, Kevin Freeman. They are pressing the institutional investors, public pension funds, and individuals, for that matter, into the worst country in the world when it comes to the environment, social justice, and good and transparent and accountable governance, namely communist China. What's up with that?
Well, that's where the money is. The Chinese pay a lot of the bills. They are a good customer, so to speak. And if you toe their line, they provide financially for you. That's what the Belt and Road Initiative is about. That's what they're doing on Wall Street. They're paying these firms big fees to look the other way and to promote their investments.
That's such a key point, Kevin, because it does seem as though they are not necessarily providing good value for the investors, but Wall Street denizens are certainly getting rich doing business with these characters, are they not?
Absolutely they are, and this is where we have crony capitalism at its worst.
I was told that Steve Schwartzman, who is kind of the poster child of all of this, who I believe runs Blackstone, pulled in something like $570 million in compensation last year, and that doesn't even take into account the, you know, rising equity values of his holdings. And he is one of the prime movers, is he not, behind this whole idea of investing in China? Presumably a fair amount of that is coming from the Chinese.
Well, and then Larry Fink with BlackRock, which is promoting ESG, and their number one priority has been stated is let's grow in China. So absolutely, this is a problem because the Chinese are playing the game pretending to be ESG when obviously they're not. And what they're doing is they're just sucking us into orbit with them, and then we get dependent on them. With a thrift savings plan, if you're invested in China, you don't want anything bad to happen to China. Well, you've just compromised American policy. And the problem is that's happening with the government employees, with the military, with veterans, with retirees. It's a very dangerous thing.
It is. And you introduced me to a woman who's put her finger on a whole nother dependency that is so frightening, especially as we see this coronavirus business playing out to the detriment of China's economy and GDP and inflation and the world economy as a result, presumably. But also, Kevin Freeman, the supply, the reliability of supply of medicines upon which we depend entirely, as Rosemary Gibson has pointed out in her terrific book, China RX, could be quite materially affected, could it not, and with dire consequences for our healthcare in this country?
Absolutely. Rosemary is a pioneer in studying the fact that most of our pharmaceutical companies have, for economic reasons, moved their manufacturing or at least components of their drug making to China, and they've outsourced it. Now China has control of it. Well, just imagine if the manufacturing is done in Wuhan or some other infected city, or if we got into a war, if they cut off our supply and access within 2 weeks, many of our hospitals would have to shut down.
Well, here's a very real consideration. We heard yesterday when the so-called New Year, Lunar New Year holiday, which had been extended, supposedly ended, the people simply were not returning to their manufacturing facilities in China. They were not opening up. They were not producing. And that presumably will begin to show up in not just, you know, your local Walmart, but also in terms of what's available in your pharmacy or perhaps your hospital as well. Kevin, let me pivot quickly to one last piece of this economic warfare environment. William Barr, the Attorney General of the United States, in recent days has made a couple of announcements, a very powerful speech about the dangers of China's efforts to use 5G to really dominate the information battle space, access to data, and perhaps the weaponization of the Internet of Things and the like. He also announced the indictment of 4 Chinese hackers who were said to be responsible for one of the worst cyber breaches of information, namely Equifax. Some 147 million of us have had their most personal data disclosed to the Chinese as a result. Talk us through what William Barr is up to and why it's so important.
Well, let's start with the idea Equifax was breached. It was breached by Chinese military personnel, it appears. It also we also know that they have breached the Office of Personnel Management. Can you imagine if I could hand someone who would be willing to blackmail both the names, addresses, and all the personal information on all government employees, and then I coupled it with exactly who they owed money to, how much money they owed. You know exactly who's vulnerable in our government. You could blackmail any one of them. You could bribe any one of them because you know who is vulnerable. And what this is economic warfare at its worst using cyber hacking. And if 5G is allowed to go forward under Chinese standards and Chinese control, then they won't even need hacks like this. They'll have immediate direct access into every person's conversations and their text messages and everything else. And it's good that we have an attorney general willing to stand up, an administration that's willing to stand up. And when I watch the Democrat primaries, I get concerned that not one person on that stage understands the war that we're in. And we've got to have our administration facing this.
Well, of course, you were kind enough to mention the Committee on the Present Danger, China, of which you are, of course, a founding member. Kevin Freeman, we have been trying in several of these early voting states, Iowa, New Hampshire so far, and shortly in South Carolina and elsewhere, to make sure that voters actually, as you've just indicated, are weighing the, well, the capabilities, the understanding, the competency of candidates that are vying for their votes with respect to China. And specifically, do they understand the magnitude of the threat, and are they coming up with plans to address that threat if they become our next commander-in-chief? This combined with, you know, trying to make sure that we're not funding some of the most dangerous things that the Chinese are up to seem to me to be two things that these key states should be focused on. To the extent that we're not seeing that, Kevin Freeman, being addressed by these candidates, it would seem to me it's kind of disqualifying. What do you think?
Oh, absolutely. President Trump is the first president since I've been working on this issue to stand up and say China is an adversary and potentially an enemy. And if we give that stance up to a new administration that doesn't understand the threat of China, then that could be the end of the American experiment. It really is that serious.
Kevin, I wanted to talk with you about, speaking of environment, social governance, the fact that Netflix seems to be censoring some of its content on the basis of deference to this sort of globalist agenda. But I think we'll have to come back to that on another day. This is a very insidious and ominous development at the hands of the globalists and needs to be called out, and I appreciate your attention to it. As to all of these issues, check out how you can find out more about Economic War Room with Kevin Freeman at economicwarroom.com. Kevin, God bless you, my friend. Come back to us next week if you would. Next up, we will be speaking with my colleague Fred Flights about all of this, North Korea, and more right after this.
Go to securefreedomradio.org today. It's your freedom. It's your country. Frank Gaffney's Secure Freedom Radio. Go to securefreedomradio.org today. It's your freedom. It's your country. Frank Gaffney's Secure Freedom Radio.
Welcome back. We're visiting with, I'm pleased to say, the president and CEO of the organization that sponsors Secure Freedom Radio. That, of course, is the Center for Security Policy. Fred Flights is his name. He is a regular here on the program, a career intelligence professional who has served the Central Intelligence Agency on the House Intelligence Committee in the State Department and most recently at the National Security Council, in the latter two jobs as the chief of staff to John Bolton. He's always a welcome here, needless to say. Fred, good to have you with us. Welcome back. I am very excited, Fred, about a speech that a friend of ours, Mike Pompeo, now the Secretary of State, made last weekend to the National Governors Association. It was quite extraordinary in that he was really speaking quite bluntly to them about their responsibility, not just the federal government's, but the leaders of our states, to help contend with the rising challenge we're facing whether it's influence operations or espionage or subversion of various other kinds by the Chinese in our states and even local communities. What were your thoughts about this speech and its contents?
Frank, it really was an extraordinary speech. One would assume that when a Secretary of State meets with governors, he's going to be speaking about trade or health issues, not China is spying on you. And that was his message. It was extraordinary. He was saying to the governors, China is spying on you, that there are Chinese affiliated organizations in your state spying on your government, spying on your people. He specifically referred to so-called Chinese friendship groups in these states that are gathering information, supposedly are trying to promote friendship and Chinese culture in these states. And he did something else that was very important, Frank. He said, look, it's important that state governments not strike deals with the Chinese government, goes around Washington, because that's what China wants to do. It wants to try to find ways to divide and conquer and to offer deals to state and local governments for trade or for some benefits without the knowledge of Washington. Washington has the goal or the task of bringing in all of our national security concerns and intelligence, so it would be easy for a Chinese official to go to a state governor in Idaho or Montana and strike some kind of a deal, and the government wouldn't have no idea what the security and intelligence implications are. So it was a very important and powerful speech.
You know, we talked a little bit earlier in the program with Kevin Freeman about the other piece of this, which I found very, very affirming, really, that our Committee on the Present Danger, China, which is sponsored by the Center for Security Policy, has been warning about for some time now, namely the degree to which, well, institutional investors like state pension funds can be enabling the threat from China because they are underwriting some of the companies that are engaged in human rights abuses among the Chinese people and for export, for that matter, as well as the buildup of weaponry with which to kill our men and women in uniform, or perhaps the rest of us as well. Were you taken by that message to the governors as well? And this is, as you know, something we've been warning about at the state level ourselves recently, Fred. Your thoughts?
Yes, that was an important point. And Frank, you deserve a lot of credit for not just raising this issue with the National Security Council high-level officials, but in your recent efforts on the ground to raise this issue in Iowa and to try to raise the message around the country that this is not just a Washington issue. This is an effort by the Chinese government to infiltrate and influence the United States at the state and local issues. So I'm glad Secretary Pompeo got into that also.
Fred, just lastly on the Pompeo address, this is one of a series of speeches that he has made both here and abroad. Notably, he was overseas warning Boris Johnson's government very firmly about the idea that it has adopted, alas, to allow this Chinese company Huawei to have a piece of the British telecommunications system. Where do you come down, Fred, as an intelligence professional, on this idea, this decision of the British government, and its possible implications for the so-called Five Eyes intelligence sharing arrangement that has long been a bulwark of our national security?
Well, look, the Chinese are trying to set up a global spy network by dominating 5G technology, by subsidizing the purchases by state and local and national governments of this equipment, because the 5G networks require very expensive and a huge amount of equipment for the system to work, and there's no way to get all the spy bugs out of this equipment. So it's crucial that America's allies not strike deals with Huawei. It just doesn't put the security and economic secrets of these nations at risk. It puts U.S. national security at risk because we're communicating with these countries, and we really need to lean on our allies to do the right thing here.
Well, and it's heartening to see, in addition to Secretary Pompeo, the Attorney General of the United States, William Barr, weighing in on this same topic over the past few days. So the administration seems seized with it. I hope that they are advancing with our allies. And that, in part, will, of course, depend on whether we've got useful and viable alternatives to Huawei, and that's a topic for another day, Fred, but I know you're concerned about that, as am I. Let me turn to one other issue that you've been following closely, Fred. Throughout your career at the Central Intelligence Agency and in other aspects of our government, you have been really one of the country's foremost experts on the nuclear program of North Korea. Donald Trump has, of course, both before and during and after your time as the Chief of Staff of the National Security Council, been pushing forward on an effort to contend with that threat, including a concerted effort to denuclearize the Korean Peninsula through a deal with the North. What's happening on that front as you see it? Is there some prospect that such a deal might be forthcoming, perhaps even before the coming election?
Well, first, I want to point out how amusing it is to hear all the Democratic presidential candidates claim they would do better than Donald Trump in negotiating with North Koreans. Frank, no, they wouldn't. The North Koreans are extremely difficult to deal with. And the president has put forward a pretty robust effort and has made the Korean Peninsula much, much more stable, much safer than it would have been without this policy. That's not to say North Korea is not an enormous threat that continues its nuclear missile programs, but at least it stopped testing its long-range missiles and its nuclear weapons, and I hope we will get to an agreement. The president reportedly recently decided that he will not try to get a summit with the North Koreans before the election, and the reason is he does not want to give the North Koreans leverage to pressure him to get a deal, knowing that if he didn't get a deal, it could hurt his reelection chances. I don't think it would hurt his chances, but that's probably the way the North Koreans would play it. We have to keep the pressure up on the North. They've been dragging their feet for the last year because they're irritated. The president will not give them what they want. Usually we go into these talks wanting a deal more than the North Koreans. The president is prepared to walk away. That's what he did in Vietnam. He'll walk away again if the North Koreans pull this. And my belief is that if the president gets reelected, there will be another summit in early 2021. And then I think there will be a lot of incentive for the North Koreans to deal at that time because their economy is going to be suffering, and I don't think they want the president to reimpose strict sanctions on them.
The sanctions are on, as I understand it, Fred. The maximum pressure campaign is continuing, though the Chinese are, of course, trying to subvert it through oil shipments and the like. What I'm particularly interested in is stitching these two topics together is, what's your assessment of the latitude that Kim Jong-un actually has to pursue an arrangement with the United States that would be in the interest of North Korea? The president has talked about, you know, economic opportunities by becoming integrated into the international community in a way that it is not today. The Chinese seem to be standing athwart any such effort. What's your reading on that, Fred?
I don't see it that way. I think if Kim wanted to strike a deal, he could. I think a more fascinating question is, what latitude does Kim have to make an agreement within his own government? What factors are there that may limit him? And I say this because of discussions I had with an advisor to an American who has traveled to North Korea and has met with Kim, went to his winter resort, and it suggested that the leadership of North Korea is more complicated than we realize. And it may take time, assuming Kim wants a deal, and I'm not sure of that, but I think it may take time for him to move the North Korean government to accept some type of agreement. I mean, I'm optimistic this personal diplomacy with the president could result in an agreement, but we have to do a lot of work. And part of the problem, Frank, is that the State Department has been undermining the president. They are too willing to get a partial deal, and I think that's another problem the president has to deal with in the next term.
The deep state exists in so many of these areas. Fred Flights, thank you very much for your time and your insights into all of this. I hope you're right about China. We'll be watching it closely, needless to say, as I know will you. Come back to us again next week, if you would. I hope the rest of you will come back to us again tomorrow. Same time, same station. Until then, this is Frank Gaffney. Thanks for listening.
You've been listening to Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney.